Welcome to Cangria, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And now it's your turn to feel a tad under the weather.
Well, I mean, I already got sick about a week ago from the two.
From what I had, yeah.
Monsters. And also, yeah. I am allergic to tree pollen, and it is that time of year.
All of the trees are having sex in your nose.
Oh my God, are they ever, yeah. And it's a lot of people don't realize that, like, literally every tree has flowers. It's just most of them are, like, small and green and hard to spot, but I know what they look like because I hate gum.
Yeah, it's that time of year. Yeah. I must be... There are some trees that pollinate once every, like, 10 years or something. So I don't get...
I don't think so.
No, yeah, there's some... They don't all pollinate every time.
Well, they don't pollinate all at once. There's that one tree that pollinates in early June that famously smells like semen.
Ew.
You can look it up online. There is a tree. It's indigenous to North America, and it smells like semen. And when one of the queens, it was either Vicky, the queen mum, or Elizabeth II, when they were in Canada, they're like, what smells like cum? And it was, of course, they phrased it a little bit less brazenly like that. But yeah. No, remarked, something smells like human male ejaculate on the wind, and they were like, oh no, it's just a tree. And she was like, peculiar. So
probably the queen mum.
I recommend you look it up. The best part, and I know I've mentioned this before, is that they're all over Toronto and they bloom during Pride. And that's by accident. That's not intentional, but it is one of the comedic joys that when you're walking down Yonge Street in Toronto, the wind will shift and all of a sudden everybody will be like, pooah!
You can't tell if you're smelling the trees or some other kind of trunks.
Yeah, and it's the smell of a man who does not have a good diet as well.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's nasty semen.
Not enough water.
Yeah, or too much grease in their diet or something.
Oh, just bad days. Now, there was a bit of a kerfuffle. We like to comment on kerfuffles.
Oh, there's many kerfuffles.
All of the kerfuffles.
Each of them.
We should just call our show Two Gay Guys Comment on Kerfuffles.
Yeah.
We're thinking of getting a new jingle, everybody. I don't know. Let us know what you think if we should change up our jingle. Fun fact about our jingle is we both interviewed Diamond Rings.
O'Regan. Something O'Regan. How could I forget his name?
Chris O'Regan?
Chris
O'Regan?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, great guy.
Yeah.
He's
really sweet. Very sweet-natured.
Is now a different kind of band. I don't know what he's doing now, but is no longer Diamond Ring.
He's in the same band, but they just keep renaming themselves to things that are not Google-friendly.
Mm.
So, like, for a while they were called the Dubervilles, but Tess the Dubervilles is this classic book, and there's, like, three or four different books. So anytime you try to look up the Dubervilles, you just get the soundtrack to any of the previous forms of Tess of the Dubervilles.
Mm.
Most of them are made by the BBC, and when the BBC makes a historical drama, they get somebody in to score an entirely authentic score just for that movie. So it's really hard to find their music. It's annoying. Yeah.
If you are good at search engine optimization, talk to this guy.
Talk to them, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, anyway. So our intro is off of one of his tracks.
Yes.
Which we liked, but we're thinking of maybe getting a new one.
Yes.
Let us know. Shall we switch it up at Talk and Queer? We'll happily hear your thoughts. Now, did you know that dudes wear makeup?
Yeah, I did. But I'm also a gay man, and I know a lot of gay men, and I know quite a few of them who unabashedly wear makeup.
I'm not talking about gay men. I'm talking about dudes.
Oh, dudes. Like bro dudes?
Yeah.
Yeah, same with them, yeah.
More, like super, super, very, very heterosexual dudes.
Yes.
Yeah. So apparently the kerfuffle I'm referring to is a brand that's called War Paint.
Okay.
Out of the... I feel like I should say it with that enthusiasm, that infliction. War Paint. Has decided to take up an advertising approach which Gillette and Axe actually decided to walk away from in the 1980s. That sort of super masculine, almost toxic masculine approach.
I mean, the ads that I saw, it was just trying to appear to men's sense of vanity. It's just the male equivalent to traditional makeup commercials for women, where it's all like flouncy music and a traditionally beautiful woman applying makeup and then putting on a pretty dress and going out and conquering the world with her confidence.
But absolute opposite. It's a guy head to toe in tattoos.
It's not the opposite. It's the analog. It is the male equivalent of that. And when you mentioned this, I was like, oh, they would do well to sell out of Europe. And you said, no, they're British, which to me makes total sense. Because I can't really see men's makeup selling as well in North America as it would in Europe.
Yeah, but not many, like, hockey players, you know, applying concealer before they go out.
But, like, well, not that we know of anyway. Mm. But the moment you started showing me pictures, I was like, oh, these are footballers. Like, this is the Beckham crowd, you know? This is the sort of, you know, middle class, wealthy, pretty good shape kind of guy who spends an hour on their hair and then goes out to the club, and they spend a lot of effort trying to look like they're not spending effort, and this would be just another way of doing it. I don't necessarily, like, not the imagery. I don't see anything, quote unquote, toxic about that. So, but I think the text, like, I think the way that you advertise it through text about, like, you know, it, I don't know, it depends. Like,
I think people are sort of taking umbrage with the subtext. So it's that sort of hyper-masculine imagery that was very, like, Axe and Gillette back in the day.
It's still around. It's not back
in
the day.
I mean, no, but Axe and Gillette have diversified their approach. Now their products are all men, not just super macho men. And that's sort of the angle that they've started with here. And also, they have messaging about how because you have testes and testosterone, you couldn't possibly have a women's makeup. You need specialist men's makeup on account of all of the oil. Now, if the ongoing scandal around the woman who's, I'm blanking on her name, Aria something or other, is any the athlete who has a high testosterone level, if that shows us anything, is that women can also have and do have high testosterone
levels. Well, yeah, but so one of the things is that during puberty, a man's skin, especially in their face, changes slightly, and it has to do with the way that collagen grows. So collagen under the skin in women's skin typically is parallel, and then in men's skin it crisscrosses. So women tend to age more gradually over time, and men tend to look fairly youthful, and then one day they just go bleh. And it has to do with the fact that the collagen in their skin is cross-linked in a special way. It also makes it tougher against, like, scratches and stuff like that, and or reputedly anyway. But men and women typically, or typical men and women typically, I'm putting a lot of hedges in there because biology is highly variable.
The Knights of Knee would be so proud.
There are differences. But again, like, you know, male and female are poles on an axis. They're not distinct categories. So you're going to have a lot of, like, categories in between. Absolutely. And you're going to have people who have, like, you know, the male typical collagen patterns in the skin on their body, but not their face, or vice versa, or something. Puberty is weird.
It was Caster Semenya was the person I was thinking of.
But, I mean, that only applies if you're talking about skin moisturizer. For every other product, all makeup is equally bad for your skin.
Yeah. Well, that's the other bit. It also claims that men need to be more cautious about what they use on their skin as regular, and they have quotes there, skincare and cosmetics could worsen the skin over time. That is, relatively speaking, true.
It's basically just only wear makeup on special occasions if you care about your skin
but
in the long
that
term.
That isn't particularly distinct to men.
No, it isn't. No.
You know what I mean? You know,
and men often have larger pores, but again, not always. Some men have very, like, bloody Phil, our friend Phil. Mm-hmm. Perfect skin, perfect cheekbones.
Oh my god, he's like a porcelain.
Yeah.
His face is like porcelain made out of baby's bottoms.
He's
like
beautiful, he's just to the point where I can't find him attractive.
I know. It's like, shush, go away. He's like a runway model.
Like Fassbender. Fassbender is so perfectly beautiful that I'm not really attracted to him. Because it's just like cheekbones and perfect skin. And like, oh, that's a nice guy.
That was this guy.
Somebody should make a statue out of him. And I'm not saying that sarcastically, but I don't know. He would have to make me laugh.
I would
be into him.
I would like Fassbender as a stat, like a water feature statue in a garden. That would be nice. I would That would be very classy.
As a water bearer, not as one of the ones that's peeing, but like one with like a pot on his shoulder.
Yeah, like a tumbling pot or something. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Otherwise, it's just a bit like Belgian boy, you know what I mean? The one that pees into a...
Yeah. Yeah.
Not so much. But what were we talking about?
Talking about makeup, yeah.
So yeah, it's sort of divided opinion.
Yeah, so I'm more on board with it than I'm not. But I also acknowledge that it's easy to do this in a way that comes across making you look like an idiot.
And the thing is, they got very defensive when people were making fun of them.
Mm-hmm.
and rightly but like, so.
You know, men can also get blemishes. They may also have patchy coloring on their mm-hmm. skin, on their face. They may want, you know, to look really good for, like, wedding photos or something. They may just be young and out on the pull. There's all sorts of reason for men to... Like, all the reasons why a woman would want to wear makeup could equally apply to men. And men do have, typically anyway, slightly different skin. And sometimes it doesn't matter, because when I was young and I went out partying, I just wore woman's makeup and whatever. I did kind of like a raver goth kind of. I don't know how to explain it, but there was bright colors on my face. And... I know, what's the word I'm looking for? Glam. That's it. I was really into glam. There's a lot of pictures of me glammed up. I was very inspired by Eddie Izzard. But anyway, point being, that was also like once every other month, and it did not impact the quality of my skin whatsoever. So, if you're going to do it more regularly, you do need something. Even women, they have different lines within brands for like oily skin, dry skin, balanced skin. So having something for men's skin doesn't necessarily... Like, it fits in, but like... If you advertise it in a way like, it's okay to wear makeup, you're not a homo, like, that's not how you do that.
And they're not explicitly doing here. And this is what I was referring to, the subtext.
Yeah.
So the products are in, like, a matte black chemical-looking, like, they look like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they, you wouldn't know their makeup. And it's, like, concealer and a face sponge, anti-shine. And it's like it's specialized just for men, and it's like it's in no. It implies that what they're not saying is in no way is this womanly and feminine and so on.
I would
and
say it's,
that's the issue.
If you're talking like, about man wipes, that I definitely think, because man wipes are just butt wipes, but in a black package, and then they charge you $1.50
it's
more.
It's like women's razors, which are the same as like the Gillette pink ones. They're just women's pens. Come on.
Disposable
now.
Razors are identical, but the actual razors, because women tend to take it into a shower, it needs to have a different grip because they're handling it when it's wet. So, I mean, it depends on what you're, like, the disposable ones, they're literally identical.
And the pens and things like
that. Yeah, the pens was stupid. That was the most ridiculous thing.
It's just gendered marketing for products that already exist. But I think people took umbrage, I love that term, with not just the Harry Potter character. People took umbrage with the fact that it's sort of playing into those stereotypes.
Well, here's the thing. Products. Anytime you depict an ultra-masculine man, I just look at them as being gay. Because, like, the guy in that commercial with the tattoos, it was like, I've seen that guy in gentleman's cinema before. Not that guy in specific, but, you know, like, that archetype of guy. And just looking at them, like, that just looks like a gay man to me.
You know, I've seen that type of guy in gentleman's cinema as well. Yeah. For me, it's, like, very much paid to gay.
Pay for
whatever the phrase is.
Gay for pay.
Gay for pay, thank you. I was really struggling there for a minute. My
little
mind was
fact
elsewhere.
For our listeners, but it's something ridiculous, like 20% of the gay male adult cinema industry is actually straight men.
Yeah. Who just get paid.
Yeah.
Must be good money in it. Now, that's a product that is very, very much not gay. It's super manly. And I want to dovetail...
Oh, don't kid yourself. There's going to be a disproportionate number of gay men buying it.
Absolutely. I actually kind of like the packaging.
And a few women with harsher skin might look at the men's products, and it actually might suit them better than women's products.
But, I mean, just before we move on to avocado, I do want to... I do want to talk about that, because what you're talking about is...
Skin types.
Yeah, skin types. And you can already get
makeup
designed for your skin type. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to have a penis on it to work on your skin.
But I mean, there are... Like, if you... Like, I had this one ex who everybody thought I was dating a lesbian for a while there. And his name was Terry, which didn't help.
I thought it was Justin Bieber for a moment.
No, but he had, like... baby skin. It was so...
Terry is that kind of ambiguous
lesbian
man.
He was so pale, and he had no pores, and he had, like, the soft, fluffy, like, watery skin of, like, a 2-year-old, but he was, like, a 27-year-old, like, 5'2". The fact that he was really short didn't help either.
Are you sure he wasn't a lesbian?
I am positive. On account of I saw him naked multiple times. But it was... Yeah, no, like, he had the skin that if he were to use makeup, he would be probably better off using women's makeup for sensitive skin because of the nature of his skin. But if you have, like, gruff, huge, poor lumberjack skin, you're probably going to want a different product. And so this is one of those things where I get what they're going for, and I, again, as I said, I support them more than I don't, but I think there's an easy way to screw up the advertising that comes off a little try-hard-ish. If you're familiar with the term tryharding.
Now, last week, we lambasted the Marks & Spencer, which is a British brand, for making the LGBT sandwich.
I was on board with it because...
You liked the look of the sandwich.
Well, yeah, it's...
I think you were hungry at the time.
It's a good-looking sandwich. And here's the thing. If you don't nail a good guacamole, it has an aftertaste like banana.
I hate banana.
And I love banana. And every so often, people will make bad guacamole and it just tastes like banana to me. And I don't mind that. But, like, you know, banana with salsa, whatever. It doesn't have the texture of banana, just the flavor. I'm on board. But, yeah, no. So I was looking at that, like, they're probably going to screw up the guacamole and make it too salty, too peppery, too banana-y. But, you know, whatever. It sounds like a good sandwich.
Yeah, it is the lettuce, guacamole, bacon, and tomato sandwich. Now, we lambasted it because we were talking about... You weren't talking. I was talking.
Yeah.
About commodification of LGBT identity. Which, yeah. In the case of last week's conversation, was companies... producing a gay thing to, or appearing to make a gay thing, like Converse has put out shoes, Adidas didn't want to get left out, so they've put out gay shoes, shoes with a pride flag on it, not like shoes that...
And it's hard to say whether it's money-grubbing cynicism, if it's optics, or if they actually care.
I know, and the thing is...
And it's hard to tell.
Is it... optics that Adidas copied Converse, who's been doing it for a few years now, and people kind of look forward to their designs?
Yeah.
Or is it that maybe Adidas decided that suddenly they really should use that? You know, it's hard to say. So we lambasted
I can't say Adidas anymore. Now I have to say Adidas because of Gopniks.
I don't know.
It's a thing. Somewhere out there, there's somebody with the Gopniks and the Kemichki, and then they're like, Adidas! And yeah, no, it makes sense. Trust me.
So the LGBT sandwich peeved me off and Piers Morgan, the only time we've agreed. And it turns out that Marks & Spencer's is actually donating nearly £15,000 from the sandwich sales to charities that serve LGBT youth.
Okay.
So... That makes me feel better. I'm like, okay, you can have your quirky sandwich.
Like, if the LGBT just showed up on their shelves one day, then I'd be okay with that. If they plastered posters all over town, then I would view it cynically. And from what we could tell, it was just one day the sandwich appeared, and they did not advertise it all over town going, look at us, look at us. So I was okay with it purely because of that. Like, if you do something to show your support and you just do it and don't advertise that you're doing it, it's sort of like there's that the parable of the Good Samaritan, that if you do a good act and then brag that you've done a good act, that's not doing a good act. You're just, you know, you have to do it for the sake of doing it. So I am... far less cynical about Marks & Spencer now knowing that not only did they just, it just showed up one day and people were buying it and they didn't advertise it all over town, and the profits, let's be honest, it's probably the profits after the cost of materials, so it'll be the...
Well, actually, not even. It's £10,000, not £15,000. It works out to be about $15,000 US dollars. That's where the confusion was.
Well, that's not even that much in the grand scheme of
things. No, and they're just, and it, you know, 10 grand to AKT, which is the National Homelessness Charity, that's $10,000 that charity didn't have the day before.
Yeah.
And $10,000 is, you know, it is a lot of time, a lot of emergency shelters.
Yeah.
It's a part-time staff person on outreach. You know, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
It can go quite far. But I think they can do better because I know who has done better. And it's actually somebody who had done considerably worse. So last year, we also lambasted Primark.
Which one's Primark?
Primark. I mean, a lot of these are British brands. Now, we don't see... We haven't seen many Canadian companies producing, you know, specifically gay things. So Winners, Marshalls and HomeSense got told off for having their logos all over Pride flags.
Oh, yeah, no, that was garbage.
Primark in the UK, which is a clothing retailer, made a whole bunch of, you know, T-shirts and things with, like, gay pride and other such words and symbols and rainbow flags, et cetera. And everyone's like, wow, so cool. You can, like, wear your pride and spend £15 on this nice shirt.
£15 on a t-shirt?
I don't know, I was guessing. Okay. But more to the point, these shirts were, all the money went to Primark. Everyone's like, well, is the money at least going to charity? Nope, just to the coffers. And all of the t-shirts were made in countries where it is very much illegal to be gay.
Yeah.
So all of their lovely factory workers, who may be gay, have to stitch together these rainbow flags knowing that they're going to a country, they live in a country where it's not possible.
So just to be a cynical devil's advocate, does anybody complain if places have, like, Christmas t-shirts and none of the profits...
And they're made in Muslim countries?
Well, no, but also that. But if they have Christmas-themed t-shirts and none of the money go towards Christian charities, if it's just, like, there's a picture of Santa and they pocket the entire profit, does anybody get upset about that?
I imagine... There are Christians who get upset at companies profiteering off of their religion.
Right, yeah.
And maybe because Christianity is so ubiquitous, that boat has possibly sailed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like there's maybe a couple more Christians than there are gay people.
I mean, I do love that t-shirt of Jesus riding a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And he's like, he's got like an M16 and he's like plowing through a crowd of, I don't remember what. I just remember seeing this t-shirt once of like Jesus riding a dinosaur.
I mean, that one might particularly upset me.
Yeah. It made me laugh a bit.
So,
but yeah, sorry.
Primark got into trouble last year, understandably so. People were not particularly impressed. They have been working with ILGA, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual and Trans and Intersex Association, which is really just like a global meta organization of LGBT organizations.
Okay.
And they've been working with them essentially to figure out how not to cock it up again.
Right.
You know, realistically, we're like, we like this whole gay t-shirt thing, but we don't want to be thrown to the wolves.
There are 74 countries that have explicitly homophobic or transphobic laws.
So don't make them there.
Yeah, there's another 50-some-odd choices. Just go with them. Yeah.
So they are actually able to... They're donating £150,000 to the ILGA.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is a huge check. And they're also making their materials in countries where it is legal to be gay.
Okay.
So that's an improvement. Anyway, we've gone from...
Although it might be one of those things where it's like, you know, cars that are like 98% made in Indonesia and then they send them to America and they bolt two pieces together, and because it was completed in America, they have the right to say that it was made in America, even though it wasn't. Like, I suspect that it's going to be like, you know, cotton that was combed in Indonesia and then spun into thread in Malaysia and then woven into t-shirts and, you know, go down the list and then finally shipped off to, I don't know, New Zealand to get the thing printed or something, you know?
Yeah.
Or that'll be the country where they stitch on the tag that says made in New Zealand or something. I don't know.
So last year they had been made in, where are we? Oh, I had the list. Turkey, China, Myanmar. Actually, it was a news story that 80% of LGBT people in China have severe depression because of the state of the rights in China. That was a study that came out.
The rights in China, the civil rights in China are not ideal, but not the worst either. I think it's more of it's the culture. It's a cultural issue.
I mean, the issue is they also partnered with Stonewall, which is a British charity, not an American charity, which one would think, given that it's named after the New York bar.
Right.
But no, it's Stonewall in the UK, who partnered with them. I think they got 20% of the proceeds from the clothes last year.
Oh, okay.
Although they were all made in countries where it's not super great. So I don't know. This is a step in the right direction. It is certainly a step up from the 15 grand off of Marks and Spencer's. And it is a opposite story than the super hetero, super macho wall paint that we started the show with. Now,
I think it's not a bad product. They're just advertising it.
This is Arcade by Duncan Lawrence, and we'll be back just after this.
I'm still fixing all the cracks. Lost a couple of pieces when I carried it home. I'm afraid of all I am. My mind feels like a foreign land. Silence ringing inside my head. Please carry me, carry me, carry me home. I've spent all of the love I saved. We were always a losing game. Small town boy in a big arcade. I got addicted to a losing.
To Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian.
Now, a little while ago, we spoke with the executive director of the Canadian AIDS Society, Gary Lacasse. Actually, you did.
I did, yeah.
And he said something which we sort of talked about, but we didn't really push as much as maybe we should have. I think what we'll do is we'll dig up the story and see if we can find it next week.
I had an hour, I had almost a 2-hour long interview with him. And at the end of it, he's like, "Do you have enough?" And I was like, "We're going to do 20 minutes of this interview, and he kind of laughed and said, yeah, it sounds about right.
So we'll take a listen through the archive tape on that one and see if we can get to it. But the CBC also recently interviewed Gary Lacasse because of what Gary is seeing as a potentially unnerving consequence of the federal government's shift towards funding prevention work, not care and support. Mm. Now, Gary's case essentially is that you catch HIV from somebody who has HIV.
Yes.
So a big part of it is certainly, absolutely, is
prevention,
not catching HIV.
Yeah.
But another part of it is working with those who have HIV to not spread it.
Yes.
Like, it, you know what I mean? It's you can't be one-sided on this. Now, HIV rates in Canada went up by 11% in 2016, for which there is the most recent data available, which is concerning. And that's roughly when the government started to shift away from treatment and care towards their prevention focus. Now, there are a string of organizations that...
Does that include palliative care? Are they defunding that as well?
Well, that's the thing. A string of organizations have effectively had their funding completely cut.
Okay.
According to the CBC story, which we will be linking on our website, www.canqueer.news, there is a number one. The AIDS Saskatoon was getting around just shy of $300,000 to help education initiatives, outreach, and a few other things, but they won't be getting that now. They're getting some different focused preventative one, but it's a complete complete loss of funding that's led to a shutdown in operations in LaRonge, Saskatchewan, where material was available in Cree and Dene. They're also seeing it, just their resources being shut down. AIDS Vancouver has had their funding cut. Luckily, they've diversified in time that they'll be able to keep going. But there was a number of other ones. AIDS Saskatoon won't be getting the $125,000 they've typically had before. And I think there was another one that the CBC quoted about AIDS of Nova Scotia got about $250,000 annually, and they won't be getting that either. So they've had to cut staffing. Mm. So in a lot of these cases, you know, the capacity of these organizations to work with people who have HIV, to get them onto medication, to get them staying on medication, which will prevent transmission.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the government is focusing on prevention, which, okay, absolutely, that makes sense. But by focusing almost solely on that, there is a risk that this other prong is being sort of maintained.
An ongoing conversation that we've been having with Gary Lacasse, because we've been interviewing him on and off for like 5 or 6 years now. We have him on about once a year, I would think, is the discussion about how much of this is the job of the HIV organizations across Canada and how much of this is the job of Health Canada themselves. And we've had multiple conversations. Also, when Liz Christie was working with the AIDS Society of Canada, ACO, AIDS Committee. No, that's Ontario. What am I trying to say? What are they called again?
CAS. Canadian AIDS Society.
Canadian AIDS Society, yeah. She was the media lady. And she said, you know, that it is a major issue that, like, also the cancer prevention societies are also going over, that it technically is the job of Health Canada, but they're contracting it out for reasons that are very difficult to explain in a one-hour format. Mm-hmm. But mostly they do their work through their funding packages, and you can tell what their priorities are according to who they're funding. And wasn't it last year that they yanked the funding by a whole bunch of organizations that have been doing it from the start and gave a ton of money to people with no reputation, no background, no
staff? I can
think
of a couple, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the issue, the federal government says that the funding priorities have not changed.
Oh, pish posh.
I mean, they should maybe let all of these organizations that got defunded know that.
Yeah.
They also say that the process was launched with a competitive solicitation process and is based on consultation with the provinces, territories, and other stakeholders.
Not-for-profits are not or should not be subject to competitive market economics. That's not how they function. That's not their purpose.
But I mean, to a degree, nonprofits have to be motivated to innovate and work, but also you develop reputations. Like, I mean, if you're working with an at-risk population, it takes a long time to develop the relationships that are needed to make sure that you know the person that maybe is at a high risk of not taking medication, who is maybe in sex work, who will, infect 10, 20 Johns that come through, you know, and those are the people that these programs are really working for. What's interesting, though, is a recent study that came out, was released in The Lancet, which is the very reputable health journal, found that seroconversion, which essentially means HIV negative to HIV positive, they studied 972 gay couples who were, one of which was HIV negative and one of which was HIV positive. And the HIV positive person was on PrEP Truvada. AIDS medication.
Yeah, yeah.
And they brought their viral loads down to pretty much close to zero. Now, at the end of this very substantial study over many, many years, they found that 15 new HIV infections occurred amongst the 972 couples, except they tested the HIV. And they were able to tell that the strains of HIV in the couple that where the other person got it was not the strain of HIV that their partner had.
Ooh la la.
So what this means...
infidelity.
It means infidelity. But much more importantly here is that this massive study of, you know, nearly 1,000 gay couples found that condomless sex, where one of them is on medication, led to a 0% conversion.
Hmm.
And this is one of the first times that they've been able to definitively demonstrate that the HIV medication is so effective that if you are on it, there is 0% conversion, which is huge.
Well, in 900 couples.
Well, I mean, there isn't even a margin of error. You know what I mean? Not one of them.
Well, I mean, this is just the former biologist in me speaking, but like, there, nature finds a way. But the point is that it is so reliable, you may as well say 100%, which in medicine is exceptional. It is incredibly rare to be that confident about anything in the medical world.
Yeah. And that's the idea of undetectable equals untransmittable, that once you've got your viral load down to X amount, that it doesn't go anywhere. So that continued care and attention, that treatment is so vital. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, we will stop the spread of HIV by having people not catch it.
Yeah.
But more effectively would be getting those who have HIV to bring their viral loads down to zero, which is not that difficult to do. It's literally just take the medication. And the medication isn't today what it was before. And if you take the medication and you're HIV positive, you know, within, I'm not sure how long it is before you become undetectable, but it's certainly not a particularly long timetable, you know, it becomes as if you don't have HIV at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we could potentially see the end of this epidemic if we both reduce the transmission, the transmittability of those who have it,
mm-hmm.
and encourage those who don't have it not to get it.
Yeah.
But going just one way down that road instead of looking at it from both sides, I think is a lopsided approach and probably not as effective.
Well, not only that, but if you look at most prevention strategies, both prevention and long-term care strategies don't just affect HIV. They also affect all the other STIs, of which there are a couple dozen at this point in time. So anything that you do to help with the long-term care and prevention of HIV, you're also indirectly helping the people who are trying to prevent, the more virulent strains of HPV, the more dangerous strains of gonorrhea, the more dangerous strains of syphilis, that everything links into each other, and that the more you help one branch of the sexual health sort of tree. Mm-hmm. The more the entire tree, I guess you could say, is helped out by this process.
Now, one of the key components of PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the medication that somebody would take. Now, there you can essentially take anti-HIV drugs when you're not when you don't have HIV, and that effectively prevents you from catching HIV.
If you take it correctly.
If you take it as per instruction.
I'm just saying that because if you look it up online, you're going to have this huge, like, there are stats on fail rates, but it's people who are not taking it properly.
Yeah. As per instructed.
Yeah.
You know, you won't, as per instructed.
Because you got to be clear, it's not a magic bullet, but if you take it as instructed appropriately.
Now I'm putting all those hedges in. Well, anyway, one of the key ingredients in pre-exposure
medicine is like that. It's not specifically HIV medication. All medicine is like that. You got to do it properly, or it's not going to work.
Truvada is a pill that was created by Gilead, which I think are the folks behind Viagra, for example. They took a bunch of the essentially some of the cocktail of HIV medication and put it into just one pill. And that is one of the primary elements of pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, which prevents people from catching HIV. Now, they put that together in 2004 with funding from the US government to kind of make that happen. They have made $3 billion in sales from Truvada in 2018. But the real story here is that the US government and Gilead have been in a bit of an arm wrestle over the royalties from that. Because, of course, government-funded research, you know, there's an obligation to kick back, you know, at least something. And Gilead has kicked back nothing.
I mean,
and made $3 billion.
Yeah.
But with all that being said, sort of money owed to the US government aside, there is some really good news coming out from Gilead. They have waived the generic version protections from their patents a year early from Teva, which is Teva Pharmaceuticals, based out of Israel. They'll be producing a generic version that will be available in 2020. So that's typically a much cheaper version that can hit the market, making it much more accessible to people. And, you know, in Canada, I believe that I'm not sure if it's covered by insurance, but if it isn't, this would be much easier. And that's the one piece of really good news. In the US, they've also announced in a partnership with the Human Health and Human Services that they'll be donating 2.4 million bottles of Truvada to 200,000 uninsured individuals each year for the next 11 years. So
where? In the UK? In the US?
In the US.
Okay.
So across the US, they're handing over 2.4 million bottles a year for these 11,000.
I wish they would do that in India and Africa.
Well,
where it's really bad. Yeah.
You know, these generics make them. So on the one hand, they've made $3 billion.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they're, you know, these 200,000 people are going to have a great time because they're not insured, but they'll be covered.
I mean,
and it circles all the way back to these 200,000 people who don't have insurance.
Yeah.
Will now not be transmitting.
Yeah.
Which means that there will be way less new people infected as a result.
Fewer.
Yeah, which is the same as way less new people.
No, it's not. It's way fewer new people. Because people are a count noun.
Oh,
you
well,
monster.
Anyway, whatever.
Somewhere out there in Radioland, there's somebody saying, thank you.
There will be far fewer people infected as a result of 200,000 people being put onto PrEP. And I think maybe on one of the rare occasions, perhaps the Canadian government should be looking at this measure where there is a bit of a focus on treatment as opposed to just prevention.
I mean, that's another thing that we could probably dedicate an entire episode to, even though it's not really the wheelhouse of this show, is the pros and cons of having private industry versus public funding do your biomedical research for you. They both have strengths and weaknesses. And, I mean, in Canada, we're kind of doing neither, which is why we're doing both, but not in a good way, which is one of the reasons why Canada is not on the leading edge of biomedical research. America, I think it's America and Scandinavia, which is both America's doing a almost purely market approach, and then Scandinavia is doing an almost purely public approach. And so they're pumping out a lot of things, whereas, I don't know, Canada and the UK are kind of in terms of our pharmaceutical research and biomedical research. Canada is doing really well for psychology and things like cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness therapy and stuff like that, but that's not what we're talking about. Anyway, I mean, I definitely recommend, if you're interested in this, looking up the debate, because it's super interesting. Because you're saying that, like, you know, this company, the US may want kickbacks from that, but depending on, I don't really know the contract of that funding, but the funding of how this sort of stuff is funded, at least in terms of the pharmaceuticals, is way complicated. And in the States, it's actually less complicated than in Canada, because it's just, this is a grant, this is for the good of the people, please try to discover something. And they're okay with the fact that it's a gamble, because the chances are you could be given $2 billion and you can't find the cure because it's in a flower and you have been looking at leaves or something like that, you know? So, I mean, it's really complicated, and there's no such thing as a good answer. There's only least worst answer, or answer that's most consistent with your national identity.
Well, Canada has another answer, which I take umbrage with.
Yeah, which is just do it wrong.
50th use of the word umbrage. And that is around Hemo-Quebec and I got the Canadian, the Quebec one, but...
Health Canada?
No, the blood people in Quebec.
Red Cross?
No, the ones that take blood.
Green Cross.
Oh my God, you're the worst.
Blue Cross. Iron Cross. Because we're all Spitfire pilots. What are you talking about? Canadian Blood Services.
Yes, thank you. Gosh, that was like blood from a stone.
I just made that up off the top of my head. Like, what uncreative bureaucrat call it? Blood Services.
So, Canadian Blood Services and Hemo-Quebec, they applied way back to get the prohibition timeline from 3 years down to 3 months.
Yeah.
Now, in the 1970s, I think it was, with the tainted blood scandal, in 1992, they banned gay men from donating blood. Oh, not just gay men, any man who's ever had sex with another man is such a ridiculous risk that they just banned them all.
Even though they tested... Well, they didn't really have good testing until the late 90s. What that means is that by 2000, they had no excuse left.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we've questioned them.
Well, yeah.
Essentially, one of two things is happening. Either they're relying entirely on the survey.
Yeah.
Have you ever done this? No.
Yeah.
Wink, wink. And not testing the blood.
Yeah.
In which case, that's risky. Or they are testing the blood, in which case, why bother eliminating this entire group of people? Now, they have been tiptoeing ever so slightly for the last several years through this ridiculous ban. Now, 3 years was better than a lifetime of abstinence.
Yeah.
Although then you had to just cross your legs and be abstinent for 3 years. And guess how many gay men opted in to donate blood? Zero.
I mean, I can tell you from experience, crossing your legs doesn't work. You need to staple your knees together.
Maybe not zero. That was hyperbole. But, you know, that's not really, you know, that's not going to drastically increase the blood supply.
No, yeah.
By having gay men have to be celibate for 3 years.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. And now they're down to 3 months, but on what evidence? And now, we literally just talked about this major study which found seroconversion of zero for those who are...
There might be a reason, because I know that there's certain medications that if you're on those medications, having those in your blood...
Then you would disclose the medication,
but it's not
based... The issue isn't based on, oh, you could have this medication.
Yeah.
The issue is behavior and it's not based on anything. It's not backed up by modern science.
And they do batch testing anyway.
Yeah, so it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So Canada Blood Services has tiptoed a little bit forward to 3 months. I can tell you that I will not be donating blood because I will not forego sex for 3 months just to appease their ridiculous policy. But maybe somebody will. It won't be me. And it irritates me that you see them massively desperate for blood.
Yeah.
And yet there are, you know, this study of 927 couples, which means that there are 927 men who are in relationships that could happily donate blood.
Well, times two.
Well, no, because one of them had HIV.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah.
So, you know, 927 men who could happily donate blood, but because of this ridiculous policy, not based in modern science, it doesn't make any sense. They're working towards it, they're studying it, then blah, 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 blah. But other countries have already waived their bans, and I think it's time that Canada maybe shuffle a little bit faster.
Well, I mean, we're... This is one of the great sins of Canadian culture is that, well, you know, that worked there, but it's not going to work here. So, like, whenever I talk with people about, like, the approach that Portugal and the Netherlands have towards illicit drugs, you know, legalize but control everything. And, you know, the Netherlands and Portugal have slightly different responses to each and to what degree they're doing what, blah, blah, blah. They've been generally very effective. You bring that up to people and they say, yeah, but that's the Netherlands. And then, but then you, what? How? I don't know. Like, I find that very frustrating. And obviously, you're going to have to adapt things to the Canadian context, but that doesn't mean you scrap the whole thing because they tried it in the Netherlands first. And there's a lot of data from overseas showing that reducing the wait times to zero and just test the blood.
Oh, my days.
Which they've got about 10 years of data, I think, out of various European countries showing that, yeah, no, it's fine. It works. And it's just, it kills me because you bring that up and they're like, well, yeah, but that was France.
We'll be following it. Now, Katie Lang was in the news. She was doing an interview with Mojo Magazine talking about how when Katie Lang came out in the 90s as openly gay, radio stations just effectively opted out of choosing to broadcast her music.
Now, when you said that, because you said we're going to do the Katie Lang story, I said, well, I know why. And then you said homophobia. And I was like, well... Yes, but also the kind of music that she made before she came out, which was drastically different from the kind of music she made after she came out. And then I played a tune for you, and you're like, that's Katie Lang, and that's what got her famous. She was a rodeo musician.
She had crazy radio plays with Constant Craving. You know, some of those hits are hits because the radio played them. And I think it was just after that, just after Constant Craving. That
it was just before Constant Craving. But Constant Craving made it big with, like, Much and the Chum radio network, which has kind of semi-dissolved as around 2004. So I'm willing to bet that it's around the mid-2000s that her music just got stopped playing because her early work, her... what is basically rodeo music. And do you know the name Stompin' Tom Connors?
It's familiar.
Yeah, he's a Canadian folk rocker, and he writes music about Canadian issues. And he actually wrote he dedicated a song to Katie Lang. It's just Lady Katie Lang. And it's about the fact that she kind of changed the position of women in country western music, especially in the rodeo scene. And then she came out, and a whole bunch of people kind of shrugged and said, is this supposed to be a surprise? And then she stuck up. She got no longer played on a lot of these, like, more conservative country western stations, which is kind of heartbreaking because she's not that bad.
Where are they playing Full Moon of Love, which is one of...
it's one of her first hits, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's all we got time for. I've been Luke Smith.
And I have been Sebastian. Thank you for listening.
Coyote, oh coyote, can you tell me why? Every time the big moon shines, you sit right down and cry. Said it's not because I'm sad that I sing all night long. I'm looking for someone to love, and this is my love song. Ooh, oh, I go crazy when that moon shines above. Someone save me from that full moon full of love. Baby, oh sweet baby, can you explain this? Every time the big moon shines, I finally get a kiss. Said it's just the moonbeams make you do these things. I think that I'll just sit right here and like that coyote sing. Ooh, above.